Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
As these countries approach us, the idea is that we've had years and years of non-reciprocal access, and it's contributed to these trade deficits.
U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer.
As the countries come to approach us, what we've told them is if you have a better idea to achieve reciprocity and to get our trade deficit down, we want to talk to you. We want to negotiate with you. And it goes both ways. Sometimes they have exports to us that are driven by subsidies and unfair trading practices. And then obviously they have non-reciprocal treatment on their end where they block our exports, sometimes through prohibitive tariffs, quotas that are not administered in the appropriate way, or other unfair trading practices. So these are the kinds of things that should be targeted. And I don't want to prejudge the negotiations, but if they're able to provide an alternative plan that can further these objectives, I think we're open to that.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We need to think strategically about tariff policy, including how to minimize unnecessary costs on American families.
Idaho Senator Mike Crapo is chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, holding a hearing Tuesday on trade and tariffs.
I also recognize that although it is easy to see the costs arising from tariffs, it's also far more difficult to assess the cost of denied market access opportunities. Tariffs can advance American interests in market access. In the first Trump administration, we saw tariffs used to stop France from imposing discriminatory digital service taxes. Tariffs also forced China to discuss the systemic challenges between our two nations. Frankly, every enforcement action, whether it's a WTO dispute, a Section 301 investigation, or a preference program review, ultimately relies on the threat of tariffs to secure objectives. Accordingly, it's important to contextualize the tariffs in the design of the larger policy. The real headline then becomes the fundamental shift in trade policy since President Trump's inauguration, where the United States now actually plans to do trade again. My colleagues and I in Congress want to pursue a real trade policy. That was put on hold during the Biden years. We now have a president who will partner with us in that effort, and together we will enforce our rights. We will negotiate again, and we will expand opportunities for Americans. This administration is not deliberating endlessly over whether trade can be a force for good, like the past administration, which refused to even engage in bipartisan or bilateral market access trade negotiations. Trade today is the centerpiece of our international economic engagement, and we have plenty of substantive trade ideas to discuss. Businesses want certainty from good policies that will continue so that they can invest confidently in prospects that create jobs and wealth. That is one of the primary reasons that I'm working hard to make the Trump tax cuts permanent, to provide businesses with the certainty they need to make long-term investments to drive growth and increase prosperity across all segments of the economy. Contrast this kind of certainty and forward thinking on trade with that of the last 4 years, where the only certainty was that you were going to lose ground because your government fundamentally rejected free markets, free enterprise, and free trade. The last administration turned to industrial policy because it was certain that the free market failed in delivering what government planners believed was necessary for climate and social agendas. Indeed, China's central planners saw their own strategic thinking in the Inflation Reduction Act's approach of bestowing massive subsidies to stimulate investments that the market would not. We can restore faith in free markets by making it easier than ever to do business in America. The president's executive order last week to assist major investors to navigate our regulatory system efficiently is a good start. We plan to do more.
Ambassador Jamison Greer heads up the U.S. Trade Representative's office.
We must move away from an economy that's based solely on government spending and the financial sector, and we must become an economy based on producing real goods and services that provide jobs for working class and middle class Americans in their communities. This adjustment may be challenging at times, and in a moment of drastic overdue change, I'm certain that the American people can rise to the challenges they've done before. I appreciate this committee's interest in President Trump's trade agenda. I'm glad we're talking about this. That's created debate. And we may not agree on everything, but I know that you want to do what's best for America. So does the president, so do I, and we'll collaborate together on this.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I raised concerns about developments related to the expiration of registrations for beef processing plants here in the United States and some non-science-based barriers, which has impacted Montana and U.S. beef exports.
At a recent Senate Finance Committee trade hearing, Steve Daines, Senator from Montana, with Jameson Greer, U.S. Trade Representative.
I want to remind you that in 2017, I went to China. I carried some steaks from a Montana rancher, Fred Wacker of Miles City, Montana. We met with the premier. In fact, I had one of your predecessors, Rob Portman, then the senator from Ohio and a former USDR with me. I had Senator Barrasso with me, Senator Kennedy with me. And as a result of that meeting, 30 days later, they lifted a 14-year ban on U.S. beef imports into China. Let me talk about what that has meant so far. This is the largest beef export market in the world is now China. For U.S. producers of beef, in 2021, we shipped $1.6 billion of beef. Keep in mind, the 2017 number was $31 million. It was $2.1 billion in 22, $1.6 billion in 23, $1.6 billion in 24. But here's the concern. That's been shut off now in the last 3 weeks. March exports of beef to China, U.S. beef, declined 92%. So the valve is shut right now for U.S. beef producers. My question is, what can we do to hold China's commitment to U.S. beef and other ag imports, which are so critical right now for U.S. producers?
Thank you, Senator, and you've always been a leader on this, and I appreciate that. China, of course, needs to take down their barriers. It's been a persistent challenge with them, and they like to use economic coercion, and they have their own method of doing things. But my hope would be is that they turn back on this course of action. I think President Trump is focused on making sure we have the right program in place, that we're dealing with partners who are going to be respectful and achieve reciprocity with us. And I think a lot of this is going to be up to the Chinese on how forward-leaning they want to be on having fair trade with us. I'm very sensitive to this issue in particular, and I want to make sure we open up beef markets other places too, so we don't have to be dependent on just one market.
Senator John Barrasso is from Wyoming.
I know you heard a lot about market access today. Just specifically discuss market access for American beef. It's our number one cash crop in Wyoming. Our ranchers produce some of the highest quality beef in the world, yet our beef faces significant barriers in key foreign markets. So I do appreciate your office's efforts to document the numerous barriers that unfairly block American beef exports. For example, Thailand imposes a 50% tariff on American beef. The European Union's numerous, quote, Green Deal restrictions limit market opportunities for our ranchers. Australia's barriers prevent the sale of a safe, high-quality American beef. They've sold $29 billion into our country. We can't sell a hamburger there. So Wyoming beef producers have felt the direct impact of these unfair trade practices, and I say it's our number one cash crop. What steps do you see being taken now to open new markets and ensure fair access for our beef around the world where we've been blocked?
So, Senator, as everyone knows, we have a lot of countries coming to talk to us right now who want to have more reciprocal trade, get their trade deficit down. And obviously part of that is making sure we have access for products like beef, making sure we're exporting products like beef. I've talked to the Australians about this issue. It's always surprising because they're a great partner for us globally. This is a big issue with them. Southeast Asia as well. These are things that are on our list when people come to talk to us. It's something we've recorded for years, and we expect countries to change this.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I think this is a continuation for policies and a way of operating and doing business with the world that he really had in his first term.
Dennis Elliott, University of Nebraska at Lincoln, livestock economist.
And really, when we think about, a lot of the things that happened, we entered that trade war with China and our other trading partners in the first term. But what was kind of the result of that? Was that China actually started coming to the table and buying U.S. beef. Any chart that you'll see that shows that really prior to 2018, no beef entered directly through the front door of China. It might have been going through gray markets, like through Vietnam, through Hong Kong, but it wasn't actually going directly into China. And since, that 2018, 2019 era, we've seen China become basically a zero trading partner for beef to our second or third largest trading partner in the world. So competing with people like Japan and South Korea. And so the fact that, that did work, that was as a way of getting in there when we talk about building, you know, demand, once people have had a taste of the U.S. beef, normally it's hard to go back from that. Consumers are usually pretty satisfied with it and keep demanding it. And so when I think about kind of where this administration goes and how it affects the beef industry, I would say it is going to impact potentially a little bit, you know, because we are taxing, you know, Japan and South Korea, our two largest trading partners. However, Mexico and Canada were taken off that, and that pretty much sums up our top six trading partners. And so that, along with kind of other animal health concerns with trading kind of trade value, has made some pretty exciting times in the import-export market.
Now, what about Mexican feeder cattle?
We went from basically no cattle entering Mexico to now, as of last week, we are almost in line with our five-year average, and last week's was exactly the number of head that we imported from Mexico was the same last week as it was a year prior. So this process that USDA has set up is really working effectively. We're able to really process cattle at the rate of commerce through the Mexican border, and in a way that is doing their best to safeguard the U.S. food industry. And so in that sense, like we did see that shock. It did ripple through the cattle on feed reports for both the February and March reports. But, you know, now I think we're back to normal, and that just kind of shows that there's going to be an equilibrium, you know, jostling out over the next couple of weeks when we think about trade and what that means. And there will be impacts on price, but there was already considerable downside in the market even prior to this when we think about just the pressure of beef prices on consumer demand and who was going to flinch. And now maybe consumers are being forced to flinch, you know, due to some policy changes rather than personal preference.
Speaking of preference, are we losing consumer demand?
Just like our consumers are feeling pressure from, you know, disposable spending, other countries are also experiencing the same thing. I think we've shown that we produce a high value product. We export high quality steaks. We're importing a lot of the grounds in. And so I think the places that we've been able to see value, we'll continue to buy those. But, you know, to what extent, you know, there's a lot of debate in the trade literature about exactly this. What is the elasticity of demand for our trade partners? And so I think there's been some estimates out there, but with these new trade tariff measures, that's probably going to create some distortion. It is a good to put in perspective, just something like kind of where that value is going. We think about, you know, we import a lot of stuff from Australia and grounds and from New Zealand. They're not a huge importer of our beef. And so there are some places that we're taking a lot of their value from, at least from the beef side, that maybe aren't being, quote, reciprocal in our total beef trade.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The Biden administration provided us with only the certainty that in the face of a foreign government's discriminatory policies like digital service taxes, data localization, or other non-tariff barriers, it would not stand up for its citizens because it believed that the so-called right to regulate trumped the principle of free enterprise.
Chairman of the Senate Finance Committee from Idaho, Michael Crapo.
Respectfully, democratic governments do not have rights. They exist to secure rights for their citizens. One immediately welcome change under the Trump administration appeared last week in the USTR's national trade estimate. Last year, the Biden administration deliberately cut from the estimate a number of discriminatory measures imposed on America by foreign governments because it sided with those governments over our citizens. This year's estimate is exhaustive because the administration carefully identified all of the ways that Americans lose out in the global marketplace. Finally, the validity of free trade will be seen again. The last administration did not pursue market access in its negotiations. Instead, it demanded governments to undertake a number of social and environmental commitments, even ones Congress did not approve of domestically. Not surprisingly, our partners did not put their trust in such negotiations. While tariffs inherently may be seen at odds with free trade, we must also acknowledge that many of our trading partners deploy barriers that have gone unchallenged for too long. Free trade, by definition, must be reciprocal. We do not have it if others can impose barriers on us unchallenged. Our failure to enforce our rights over the last 4 years lost a lot of ground for us. This cannot continue because what I am certain about is that American goods and services are innovative, high quality, and globally competitive. Senior administration officials say that a number of countries are coming to the table to engage with the USTR. We look forward to hearing about this engagement and the steps toward better opportunities for Americans.
Ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee from Oregon, Ron Wyden.
So you look at Stellantis, the auto company, laying off 900 workers in response to the tariffs. I talk to Pacific Northwest fruit growers who are being told no more American exports, and I hear from small businesses in Oregon that they'll have to pay more for the materials they use to make their products. And I worry that Americans will soon be poorer and face greater threats to our national security thanks to these Trump policies. Is that the plan? Colleagues, I'm going to close with this. The Trump aimless, chaotic tariff spree has proven beyond a doubt that Congress has given far too much of our constitutional power over an international trade to the executive branch. It is time to take that power back. On a bipartisan vote, 51 senators sent that signal last week by stepping in and passing legislation to lift Trump's reckless tariffs on Canada. Well, now Donald Trump has slapped tariffs on about 180 countries, and this is a big unforced error that requires a big response. So let me close with this announcement. Today, I am proposing a new bipartisan privileged resolution to end the latest crop of global tariffs that are clobbering American families and small businesses. Members on both sides of the aisle ought to know that this is a call to action, and Congress must step in to rein this president on trade.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
This year that change has gone from March 15th being the deadline to sign up for the different programs that are available through the Farm Bill. And I'm talking about the Farm Bill that is currently in place, the 2018 Farm Bill.
Mark Brown is with Plains Cotton Growers, talks about the April 15th deadline for ARC and PLC.
Whenever we look at that, normally March 15th is the sign-up deadline for the ARC versus PLC decision. Now, however, this year they've extended that until April 15th, so producers do have a little more time. Now, one trick about that is depending on what you chose for your crop insurance could have an impact on what you're eligible to participate in, especially in the cotton world, and even more particularly if you are considering taking stacks out on your insurance program. And so those are things that will come into play on this decision, but again, a little bit of time extension as far as making that final decision on the ARC versus PLC at the county FSA office, and people can either sign up for that online or they can contact their FSA office and do that in person, and we've got just a few more days, and this one lines up with the tax day, I believe, this year, so it'll be an easy way to remember that.
But with extremely low prices, could we see a move out of more cotton acres?
You know, whenever we look at production across the United States, corn is one that, even though the price is not tremendous on corn right now in comparison with other commodities, it competes pretty strongly. And so in some areas of the nation, I think we'll see more corn production. Whenever they came out with the March 31st planting intentions, that was down slightly from the original estimates. And they currently have the U.S. projected at 9.87 million acres of cotton production for the U.S. Now, bringing that a little closer to home, as I visit with people in some areas of the panhandle, where there are other options that are available, such as grain crops or silage, then I think we may see somewhat of a decline in cotton acres here, or we may see cotton shift over to more dryland acres. But also, what I'm hearing is where people are using a cotton and grain rotation, that they still have full intentions of sticking with that rotation. And so I think that's what we will see there. And then as we get on the southern end of our production region. As we talk about different options, there's just not much that's available that works well outside of cotton and maybe peanuts on that southern end, where they can get the contracts and where they have the irrigation capability. But I think we'll still continue to see cotton acres produced in that area. So overall, we're anticipating a slight decline in our acres, but we still would expect that in the PCG service area that we're still going to see somewhere in the range of around 3.5 million acres planted. And so now we just have to wait and hold off and see what kind of moisture that we get. I know that in the northern area that the planters will be rolling on cotton pretty soon. And then, of course, down in the southern end of our region, they'll have until June the 10th to get cotton acres in. So a lot of it will depend on what Mother Nature does.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Could you talk a little bit about the relationship of the tariffs that you have put on and rising prices for the American people? What is it the American people should expect to be able to suffer as a result in terms of rising prices? I understand your position is that the long-term gain is worth the short-term pain, but what is that short-term pain going to look like?
Colorado Senator Michael Bennett at a Senate Finance Committee hearing on trade with U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer.
I think we should look at history and data for this. It's hard to project what's going to happen with prices, but we know in the first Trump term, the president imposed historic tariffs on China on an enormous amount of goods coming from China. And during that time, inflation went down by 0.1%. During the Biden administration, the historic inflation was not on imported goods or related to tariffs that President Biden put in place. It was related to, frankly, services, healthcare, education, et cetera. So I think there's not really a one-to-one on tariffs and price effects. And so many things go into price. I know you think I'm probably like dodging and weaving on this, but I'm looking at data, sir.
Yeah,
and the data shows it's not one-to-one.
I know you're smart enough to know that the likelihood is that prices are going to go up for the American people as a result of the tariffs that you put in place. Do you disagree with that?
I think
when you say that the American, in your testimony, that you expect the American people will bear the burden, or that, and I'm sure they will bear any burden on some level. But what do you think that burden is actually going to look like?
Well, I think the challenges, frankly, are going to be more for companies that are largely dependent on imports from China and Asia, where they have to adjust their supply chains in a quick set of time. Yep. And the way the tariffs get allocated between the foreign the foreign producer and the importer, that's where the majority of
adjustment comes. And we have a bunch of those companies in Colorado, and I know that Osprey Packs, for example, they probably don't want me to mention them, but I will. And in Southwest Colorado would be a very good example of that. I mean, they are very dependent on the supply chain from Vietnam, and they probably are really worried today about what's going to happen, which a lot of people are. I mean, I think one of the things about the situation we find ourselves in is the degree to which we've now created huge uncertainty in our economy, and I'm worried that that is going to result in a lack of investment, capital investment. You mentioned some new investments that have been made in our economy, but I think that anybody who knows anything about the economy knows that uncertainty results in people freezing up, a paralysis, a lack of investment, which is going to make it hard for our economy and may actually provoke a recession. Could you comment on your concerns about that and how you're thinking about that? And I have one more question before I'm out of time.
So Senator, the best way to have certainty is to build in the United States, right? That's the best way to have certainty.
But that's going to take a long, long time. And what's going to happen in the meantime, do you think?
So, Senator, we have, I would say, dilly-dallied for years on this issue. We've done these broad studies, which are interesting and helpful, that we talk about the Biden administration.
Right.
But we have to act. I can't sit for 3 years and try to find something.
I hear you. I hear you say
emergency.
That. But you could have made a different choice, which was to strategically target a geography, to strategically target Beijing, strategically target certain industries where all industries in America weren't affected at the same time. You didn't make that choice. I mean, you're in the midst of having trade negotiations with 90 different countries at the same time, by your own testimony, all of whom can make their assessment, I assume. These are sophisticated people.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So as you know, yesterday the President directed Secretary Best and myself to interact with the Japanese. We've already been having several conversations with them over past weeks. So this is not a new development, but we are taking it to a new level.
U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer.
Obviously, we want to have more market access in Japan. For us, we feel like we could have more and better agricultural market access. There are also structural impediments to some of our industrial goods in terms of standards and regulations and that kind of thing. I also think that there are things we can do with our trading partners, things that aren't always purely in the trade sector with respect to economic security, whether it's export controls alignment or investment screening alignment or energy, making sure that our partners are tied up with us with respect to liquefied natural gas and other resources, as opposed to being dependent on other countries that may not be as friendly. And so I think all of these factors will go into these discussions with Japan in the coming weeks.